You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
I was curious who Carver would send.
He's on to you.
Well, you know where you stand. You made your bed.
I'm standing in your doorway.
Then turn around and go home. You can tell him you didn't get anything out of me.
That's it? Go home?
I didn't ask you to get involved in this.
It's too late for that.
Why did you marry him?
He told me he loved me.
Oh, that sounds good.
Do you know I used to look in the papers every day for your obituary?
Well, I'm sorry I keep disappointing you.
What was it, James? Did I get too close? Did I get too close for comfort?
Yes.
Hello and welcome, everybody, to the 602 Club, Trek FM's General Geek Show. I am the host here, Matthew Rushing, and I am pleased, as always, to have some incredible guests with me tonight as we are going to be diving back into the world of James Bond. As of this recording, we will only have two James Bond films left, which makes me so sad. But never fear, they are planning another Craig film, and we may, yes, we may just go back and look at Never Say Never Again. So, Never Say Never Again. Of course, you know, if we're doing Bond, I've got these incredible panelists that are here with me, and I'm so thankful to have them back. Christy, how are you doing?
I'm good. I've settled in. I've got my fancy black dress on with my boa and my diamond earrings. I'm ready to go. You're not going to get rid of me.
Man, you get so fancy, so fancy. I don't know. Well, John, is that... No, that's not a martini shaker. That's just water bottle.
Yeah, it's just water. Well, Christy showed up themed in the black evening dress and the boa. I thought I would show up themed having just come out of a slum shower in Hong Kong, just completely drenched and handcuffed. So that's going to be my look.
Wow, showing up to a show handcuffed.
Mm-hmm.
They even left you with the soap.
How you got there?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
Oh my. Well, gosh, I feel so underprepared just for my Mumford Sons T-shirt. But before we do dive into the show, and we're talking about Tomorrow Never Dies, make sure you check us all over the place. We are everywhere. Here is Trek FM. But it's been a while. Go over to iTunes or Apple Podcasts, whichever you prefer, whichever medium you're on, and give us a star rating and review. Help people find the show. You know, it is one of the best ways for people to be able to find the show is by you giving us a star rating and review. So be sure to do that. You can find us, though, wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us on Twitter, Trek FM, Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. We're also over on the web at trek.fm. You can check out every single show that we are doing there, as well as as you're there, maybe you want to get to our listeners-only discussion group. There's a couple ways to do that. You can hit discussion on any of the menu bars there on the show pages, or you can go over to Facebook. Type in Babel into the search field, and that will get you over to the listeners' discussion group, where you will have the opportunity to talk from listeners all over the country and all over the world as we discuss everything that's going here on Trek FM. And then last but not least, you can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Make sure you are liking us there on Facebook, following us on Twitter, and all of the other places you can find us, like Instagram and everything like that. So, guys, we are continuing Bond, and I thought this was really interesting. You know, we talked about last time how big GoldenEye was and how much pressure there was kind of on that film coming back. We need to bring Bond back in a big way. But I think this is interesting, too, because of the massive success of GoldenEye, they now have pressure on them to try and repeat this. And so they've got no Fleming material left. So, of course, they're making this up. And I thought it was really interesting that Bruce Fernstein, who was the original writer on the... There's a lot of rewrites that happened. There's a lot of people who got their hands on this. But his idea was his inspiration for his experience in journalism and how he really kind of wanted to ground this in that nightmare reality of journalism and what it was becoming. And I thought that's such an interesting place to start for a Bond film. And when I think of Bond movies, that's not necessarily where I think I would first go when trying to come up with a story for a new Bond movie. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I think that it's a good idea in theory because it's creative. It's something we haven't seen before. You certainly don't think your villain is going to be the leader of a media company. Why would he want to take over the world? But I think that it's a good thing in the sense of what you said, Matt, about how it's a nightmare of reality, that it's something that you could totally see being plausible. And I think that's what makes it, as we've said of other films in the past, makes it grounded. And I've always really liked films that stretch something that you think is plausible enough to come true. Sort of the Frankenstein's monster aspect of it starts with one thing and then snowballs into something you didn't plan for. But I think that the villain was a little weak in making that come forth in the movie. I think that the henchmen were a little more terrifying than he was, because it seemed like it sort of the press orange for murder thing again, where it's just a guy telling other people to do all his dirty work.
Nice. Yeah, I had really mixed feelings about the villain. Not because I think Jonathan Pryce is bad in any sense. He's clearly enjoying playing this over-the-top bad guy. But the thing that struck me as odd is that I liked the idea that he was a guy who wasn't just trying to take over the world for the sake of taking over the world, because there are a lot of Bond villains where it's just like, I'll do this and then I'll have more money than anybody. I'll take over the world. I'll create political unrest here. This character, Carver, just really seemed to delight in the manipulation of it all. Mm-hmm. So there was that he had going for him. And he clearly delighted in the behind-the-scenes power that he had. Like, there's that great sequence with all the world leaders on his screen, and you got Michael G. Wilson in a cameo there. So all of that is fun. And I thought they're really treading an interesting line here, because it's the movie doesn't have to make a statement about media or the state of manipulating media or anything like that. All that has to do is just sort of be believable enough as a thing to the audience. It doesn't need to get into the complexities of journalistic bias or who's pulling the strings, who's doing what. It really doesn't need to be accurate or very thoughtful with any of that. It just sort of has to play into the zeitgeist. It has to play into this idea that people in the audience might have and go, oh, yeah, you know, I kind of always thought that the news was a little weird. this is a fun way to explore that.
For me, I thought it was really nice to kind of start with something so grounded, which, you know, Bond doesn't necessarily always do. And so to think of kind of a very real world scenario and real world place to kind of pin the story, I thought that was interesting. And I would say, except for a few elements, this Bond movie is one that is quite grounded in its villain, in what the story is, what's happening, and whether or not this could actually happen. You know, there's so much of the movie, I feel like, in the story where it doesn't feel all that stretched to be like, wow, this could possibly happen. You know, especially with the way it plays out, with the way they use the technology and everything. So it felt like a good place to ground the movie and then allow maybe the Bondness to take over later on. But I do think, to me, thinking of this kind of as a starting point, you know, a cornerstone for this next Bond film, it was nice for me to feel like it wasn't like we're trying to outdo GoldenEye and necessarily make it bigger. We're definitely trying to make it different. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really nice, at least here, before we completely get into everything else, you know, I feel like the intention here is really smart with where they're thinking of the story structure.
Well, it's a cool idea to ground it in something that is a little more understandable for the audience. Like, oh, okay, well, he owns newspapers and cable channels and this, and he's amassed this fortune, and he's a little off his rocker, so he's taking it too far, as opposed to, here, believe this guy who's just some strange person of unknown origin who can suddenly take satellites out of the sky. You know, there's something about this from the get-go that is a bit more believable. Where it stretches credulity is that, you know, like I said, the character of Carver just sort of needs to play into the audience fantasy that it's one evil guy who controls everything. And that's what makes us crazy, whether it's, you know, the headlines in the papers or creating the news, which is the kind of running gag in the movie, to that bit of throwaway dialogue of, oh yeah, well, we're going to release the new OS and we filled it full of bugs, so people have to upgrade for years. You know, again, that's the sort of handed right to the audience to say, here, we're going to enjoy this ride down this conspiratorial fantasy that will work for this movie.
And I have to add too, the whole subject matter of this is perfect timing as well, for the 90s being when all of these movies were coming out dealing with the manipulation of technology, because it was advancing so fast. They were making movies like Hackers had just come out, and The Net, and all of these things about people abusing that technology. So it fit right in with all the other films like that of the 90s anyway.
Yeah, for real.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. You know, it's one of the things I like you pulling up. You know, you think of a silly movie like The Net with Sandra Bullock and how, you know, crazy, ridiculous it looks now. Mm-hmm. But then there's such a, it feels more real, you know, and I love this, this idea of where we're starting. And I think it's interesting. There is a Star Trek connection here. We get tons of rewrites happen on this movie, but we do get one of the biggest rewrites happens with Nicholas Meyer. He's brought in to perform a massive rewrite, which everybody knows, if you know Star Trek, did the same thing for Star Trek II, and then, of course, directed that and directed Star Trek III and Star Trek VI, and has been tangentially linked to Discovery, although I don't know how much input he really has had on Discovery. But I think it's fascinating to see, because he is one of those people, a lot like in the background, like Carrie Fisher, where they came in and they doctored strips for people. You know, they fixed scripts, and you may never have known it. In fact, his name isn't on the credits. I think it's on the adaptation, the book if I remember correctly from my research. So, you know, he doesn't even get a credit, but he is a person who had an influence on this film. So I thought that was interesting. They did want to go with Martin Campbell as director, but he said no. And so instead, they get somebody that they had tried to get before. So they get Roger Spottiswood. They had wanted him to direct a Bond film with Timothy Dalton in the lead role, but of course that did not work out then. And so he's back into the fold and directing this film. And, you know, I would say director-wise, I didn't feel too much of a difference between the way that that Campbell did things in GoldenEye and the way that this film works as well. I felt like they work very nicely as companion pieces, and they felt very similar in a lot of ways. And so I felt like they did a great job choosing a director who could come in to pick up where Martin Campbell had left off. And it, at least, you know, when it comes to direction, I don't think he skipped a beat, honestly.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I'm glad that you mentioned it as kind of a companion piece, kind of a continuation from GoldenEye. Not with any level of the plot, but it just feels like we're very much in the same world. There's nothing stylistically that has been reinvented here. So I think Spottiswood did the right job by not overdoing his job.
I didn't even think about that, but you're absolutely right. In many ways, it kind of felt like when, some of the early directors swapped places and you didn't necessarily feel like there was a huge change. You know, you felt that continuation, especially I think in the Connery films, the first four, at least, you know, you really did feel a lot of continuity between them and just kind of the way they looked and the way it felt. So yeah, I think this was a really smart thing, and it'll be interesting to see if that is something that continues as we continue on with the Brosnan era. I wanted to ask you guys, you know, I feel like the opening action sequence it's very big and it's very bold. And I felt like it feels a lot like a lot of older Bond films all put together. And I wanted to see what you guys thought of it, because, you know, they're always trying to kind of find a way to outdo themselves when it does. I mean, this is the one place where it does feel like they're trying to outdo themselves is with the opening action sequence. And how did this movie is we're coming back into the Brosnan era. How did this one live up for you guys?
I did definitely feel what you're saying, Matt, like it was a Bond greatest hits in that opening sequence. You've got Russians again, or supposed to be in Russia. You've got, a group of terrorists all gathering together about, you know, all these different weapons, and you're trying to ID people. And then, you know, we, of course, bring back in M, and then she's having to argue now with the government and the military. And then, you know, I like that they kind of bring in Bond in a subtle way, calling him White Knight this time. That was cool. But yeah, I think otherwise it feels very familiar, but in a great way. I feel like Arnold dealing with the music, and then the actors as well taking good direction made a lot of intensity in that scene. So you don't feel like you're moving into the film slowly. They're coming at you full force, and then, you know, Bond runs off with the plane. So I really liked it.
Yeah, and what I love in that opening sequence is not showing Bond for a little while. Mm-hmm. Like, we know it's coming. We know exactly what's coming. But just giving us a little bit of a delay, a little bit of time for it to sink in. You know, we already met Brosnan in the last movie, but it's almost like they felt like they had to reintroduce you to Bond this time around. And I'm glad they did. And I love that action sequence kept going. Like, you think it's going one place and then it keeps going and then keeps going. The tension feels real. The stakes feel real. I know that we'll talk about the other people in Bond's life in this movie, but I have to give a special shout out to the character of Charles Robinson, who we meet here, played by Colin Salmon, who I just think is one of the coolest people in film ever. He's got a tiny role in this, but he's got loads of presence, and I think he's badass in that, you know, 30 seconds we get of him on screen.
One of the things that really stuck out to me about the action sequence is how it did build on GoldenEye and the relationship between M and Bond, and how much that's changed. You know, in the first movie that we get Brosnan, he's a misogynistic dinosaur. Here, he's her most trusted agent.
Yeah.
You know, and she trusts him and his gut in a way that, you know, she's defending him with the Admiralty. And which I actually really liked too, because the, you know, Bond is a commander in the British Navy. And so the fact that the Admiralty is there kind of makes sense, you mm-hmm. know? And so, and just kind of the way this all works, and also just the action sequence being in the late 20th century, you know, where we're having these spy cameras and everything, and we're what's happening at home with M and everything. They could be much more involved with Bond in the field like this. I thought that was really well done. And I just think the action sequence itself is fun. It's really well paced. You know, like you said, John, we wait for a while to meet Bond, and then once we do, he looks, you know, swashbuckling and debonair, you know, and all at the same time rugged. You know, mm-hmm. he's got his like fatigues on and stuff, sweet jacket, everything, and just like it's a really is just a I it's kind of a heart pounding scene, you know, and you're just waiting for how he's gonna get out of it. You know, he is gonna get out of it, but then the way he does is kind of I don't know, it there's so much happening, and it feels like a lot of different movies, but it has that kind of fun, almost Top Gun type ending to it. You know, he shoots the guy behind him into the plane above him, and he flies away, and, you know, he saves the day. And I thought that was a great way to start this Pierce Brosnan movie and just kind of bring you back and make you super excited for what's going to come next.
And having a countdown going literally the entire time, I think also really built the intensity for me.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
One more thing that I really noticed too, as we were kind of talking about relevance, you know, this actually really fits the time period too, and something that's going to become more and more accentuated throughout the years, which is this idea of a terrorist black market, which is what this is. And it's something that, you know, just a few years later is going to be the scare of everybody in the world, that this would happen, that bombs of these magnitude would end up in the hands of terrorists. And so the fact that the Bond writers are kind of seeing this already at this time period, I think this is one of the places where I do start to see that this movie is putting Bond on the cutting edge again, instead of Bond being one where we're just copying the edge.
Or being way behind the time so that it's embarrassing.
Right.
Yes, no blaxploitation here.
No.
But I found that to be something that it really drew me back in, you know, rewatching this time, how there was, you know, even at the beginning, even at the opening credits here, there is this relevancy, and I really liked that. And I think, you know, the idea of relevant story and relevant villain, as we kind of touched on just a little bit, but I wanted to dive in more with you guys, is, you know, I don't know about you, but I was rewatching this and thinking, this seems even more relevant today than it did then. When you think about the idea of, like, 24-hour news, social media, the way that people use this type of power, the way we all fear people actually do use this type of power, and the fact that the villain feels like you've taken Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, and Rupert Murdoch and rolled them all in the one. I don't know. There was just something about that. I was like, wow, they really were. They were on the cutting edge, I think, with this story.
Well, kind of like I was saying before, though, I think it's relevant because it's all stuff we know, but it's like they're doing the fantasy version of that. Like, no doubt, there are powerful people in the world. There are powerful people who who delight in manipulating the messages that we get from the media we consume. I mean, man, if only this movie had been made in the era of Facebook and Twitter and social media, now that we have attached to our hands and in front of our eyes 24 hours a day, in addition to 24-hour news, and the simply the way that the spin of news stories is played with in this movie, it's all pretty incredible. I think I still have to temper that in my head with the idea that this is a movie where in the end the good guy has to kill the bad guy, you know, and I think there's something really clever that they do that's almost a throwaway, but I wanted to pose it to you guys. What do we think at the end of M's little white lie in reporting Carver's death?
Oh, I cracked
up. Because, okay, it's funny, but, and I did too, because she's so wonderful. Judi Dench is just great in every moment. But it's sort of like, does it tell the audience, okay, there are bad lies, but there are good lies too? You know, as opposed to holding just sort of the truth of journalism as a separate and whole ideal that we should be concerned about. Instead, we say, well, in this case, here is this one bad guy who had so much control and could spin a story and create a story however he wanted to. But as long as that power is in the hands of people that we agree with, then we're okay with that.
Right.
I mean, I know it's there for fun. I know it's there as a joke, but it just sort of left me thinking like, okay, we weren't okay with making up headlines for the first hour and 57 minutes.
Right. But now we are.
Now we're in the last minute. We're like, oh, okay. That's just sort of the reality now that we have to sit with. But no, I think that's part of what makes this movie so much fun. By the way, the only thing that is not relevant now, I think he was using Quark Express to lay out his headlines. I'm just going to, that very much struck a place in my heart, having used that program a lot in the 90s.
Yeah, it looked like the software I used in like layouts for the yearbook in high school.
Right. Yes.
Like, wow, yes. That's how you're doing that. Okay.
So I think you brought up a kind of an interesting, really interesting philosophical question that the movie doesn't do anything with. But the idea is, with that, you know, is it okay for the government to tell a white lie like that to cover up things? And maybe, you know, to allow a person to die with dignity that they didn't earn, you know, because in the end, what she's doing is actually a favor to Carver.
Mm-hmm. It's a favor to Carver. And you have to think, though, that, okay, how do we actually tell the real story? Okay, so there's this media mogul and he's got a stealth boat and he's stealing weapons. And also he's right. Making up all these other...
He's trying to start a war with China and Britain. Like, we got to stop
right,
this.
Right, tried to start a war, and we also have our top secret agent who destroyed him with a sea drill, which is hilarious and gruesome and kind of dumb, but it had to end that way.
Yeah.
You know? That's kind of a hard story to tell in the press. Better just say, suicide. We're not really sure of the rest
of the
details.
So really, the sea drill was the shotgun over the fireplace.
Right. Yes.
If you're gonna show it in the beginning, you gotta use it later.
Bravo.
Oh, that's awesome.
But,
bravo. That's awesome.
But I do
Chekhov sea drill.
Yeah. But I do agree that like it's sort of a favor to him in that too, like, how is M gonna cover up technically her agent murdered the guy? Like, she can't just say that on, you know, international news.
Mm-hmm.
We took him
and
out.
You got to protect the agent too. Yeah,
right.
Well, and you have to protect. I mean, we're talking about, you know, you're protecting the country and the world in the sense of like there are secrets that the government are required to keep for our safety. You
right.
know, like what happened here was that one of the most important pieces. Well, they also are protecting the American government too, because one of the most important pieces of the American government is stolen. that encoder that allows this whole mess to happen. So it's not just, you know, it's not just about necessarily telling the truth. It's about what that information would do in the public sphere and making that determination. And obviously, again, we already mentioned it's a joke in the movie. But well, what we're talking about is really interesting.
Yeah, I think going back to your original point here, Matt, it's that the character of Carver is symbolic of these things that drive us crazy. So he doesn't have to be realistic in a totally real sense, but he has to be realistic enough to represent the things that drive us crazy. I can't walk into a movie theater and necessarily believe that a guy has a stealth boat and can steal weapons, but I know that I've been really frustrated with my computer's OS, and man, oh, there's got to be somebody behind it who's just messing with me. Like, that's a really satisfying belief to have. Even when you examine it, it's not totally true. Or here's a multitude of news stories out there, and I just know that the way some of these news stories are presented, they can't really be real. There's got to be somebody who knows more than anybody else who's pulling the strings. Well, again, on close scrutiny, it's not exactly like that, but it plays into what our feelings are. I think that's really the brilliance of the character of Carver.
And there was one part, though, that was totally realistic, because I saw this happen recently in Georgia.
Which is?
The political part of, oh, yeah, it's basically signed.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, there right. are people going, yeah, sir, if you'll just sign this real quick, thank you.
Uh-huh.
And then these right. laws get passed that you're going, how is that a thing? And now it's yeah. legal?
Yeah, right, right.
Sorry.
Well, and I think the thing that he's that makes him so fascinating is that he is wagging the fake news.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's using news to create more news so that he's more popular and more needed, you know, in the world. And I think that's the thing that is, you know, we are in this 24-hour news cycle now. And in a lot of ways, the 24-hour news channels make news so that they can have something to fill the time.
Right.
Yeah.
Which, yeah. It's not good. You know, I mean, when we turn national tragedies into 24-hour, just, you know, 365 days a year, you know, things. It's just, we can see the problem with this. And I think the movie does such a great job of showing how ridiculous it is that we've allowed this to be okay, and that we consume news now is entertainment, which is exactly what Carver is kind of turning his news into. It's entertainment for people.
Yeah.
And he's a guy who doesn't have a political point of view.
Not at all.
Yeah, it's just purely, I can profit from this. I can profit from the misfortune of others. And as long as I'm ahead with the better, more salacious story, if it bleeds, it leads, then I will benefit from this.
Mm-hmm. And loves making people fools.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, I would say what's also really interesting for me in with Price is that you have him as the character, and I think one of the things that I really like about the casting is that he's a diminutive guy compared to everybody else in the film, and so it is almost as if he is overcompensating for something, and it's the fact that he doesn't feel big enough next to everybody else, and so he's got to be bigger and better and be able to destroy anyone he needs to with the, you know, swipe of a one-handed keyboard, you know, so that he can, because, I mean, I don't know how he types that fast and makes it actually
with
work.
With just his right hand.
Works, yeah.
I know. It's amazing. But, you know, that's one of the things I thought that was kind of smart in the casting, because he is this, you know, flamboyant, over-the-top guy, but it makes sense for somebody who, when you look at him, you know, and you put him up to next to somebody like Bond, yeah, he feels unworthy, right? You know, why do you think he's insecure about his wife? I'm, you know, and where she's been and who she's been talking to and all this stuff, you know? So I just, I think that, again, they did a great job with the villain and who he is. The only downside to this villain is two words, stealth boat, because it don't make no sense.
Or call it something else.
Was that a double negative? I'm sorry, am I not supposed to use double negative?
Right.
It doesn't make any sense to have a stealth boat because that it doesn't work.
Because now, this thing is huge. It's got to be big enough to hold all of these missiles and stuff.
Yeah.
But no one's going to see it or hear it.
It's maybe they should have called it stealth-ish.
Right.
You know? It's
sneaky boat.
Yeah, it's stealthier than other boats. But,
But it looks like a giant turtle.
Right.
Like,
yes.
No one's going to go, that looks weird.
Yeah. But here's the thing. There are the Navy does have there are stealth ships that exist. Now, to the extent that they can do what this ship does in the movie, movie's taking some creative license. But the idea is that you have ships that can evade radar and sonar and traditional detection methods. However, if you're there far enough away to see it coming, well, there it is.
And
a lot harder to hide.
But it's painted matte black, John. You can't see it. It's painted matte black.
That's the color of the ocean.
Yeah. Exactly.
No, the other thing that I think is funny too is I'm like, if it's gonna be some kind of a stealth thing in the ocean, isn't that just a submarine? Like, why did it always have the top sticking out of the water?
Interesting. Yeah.
Why isn't it just like, you know, the Red October? You know, that makes so much more sense. To have the caterpillar drive that you can't really hear, you know? So, and, you know, you have to have the guy who understands what's a caterpillar drive and what's not whales humping, you know? That's what you need. Like, this would make so much more sense, but no, stealth boat.
And just, they even call it that
part
in
the
movie.
They even call it that in the movie. And it just... it's the one thing in the movie that just kind of like hurts the rest of the film because it's so dumb. I can't believe it. Like, I can't believe it's not better.
It would be like Batman in the middle of Batman versus Superman going, I'm going to my lair. Like, you would. No, you don't say, I'm going to my stealth boat. Like, it just sounds ridiculous. Anyway.
Enough about the villain and stealth boats, but man, we had a great conversation there. Some real depth to that, which I love. I love that we can pull that kind of stuff out. And I do think that that's one of the hallmarks of this movie. It has some of that stuff in it. But we have two Bond women in this film. We actually have three, but I don't know if we want to count the linguist teacher. She's barely on screen, you know.
Yeah.
Although I do want to point out, and I thought this was interesting for you guys, this was the first Bond movie, I feel like, where they really started to kind of push the sensuality in the sense of, like, showing more. Because, I can't remember the last time we saw a woman's butt in a Bond movie. Like, there's some actual nudity in this movie, you know, or close to it, which... you know, most Bond movies, you know, they flirt with that. But this one, I felt like they actually pushed the boundary a little bit in that. Maybe it's because it's 1997 at this point.
Yeah.
Well, and I kind of wondered if they did that because, you know, they're really... obviously, Terry Hatcher is only going to be on screen for a little while. And then the relationship with Michelle Yeoh as Wai Lin is a very different thing. So I don't know if in the scripting process, if that scene was added in just to kind of sex it up a little bit. It's kind of out of place. I think about other scenes and other Bond movies where they've pushed it a little bit. Think about, in Thunderball, you know, you get a little more skin than you have up until that point, and then there's less in other movies and a little more in other movies. But I wondered if they at some point had kind of had this thing plotted out and determined what the relationships were going to be and decide, you know, we should throw in something a little salacious too.
Well, and I even wonder, back to like them going with what was going on with other movies of the time, if they were kind of doing that, because in when I was looking at what movies were coming out around the same time, Showgirls was in 95 and Striptease was in 96.
Wow.
So I kind of feel like that may have been part of it too. They're just like, well, sensuality is like the thing now, so we got to push the envelope.
Interesting.
I don't know.
Yeah, and it was an interesting scene because you don't necessarily need it, but it's that bridge scene for what, you know, Bond is doing after he comes back from a mission, you know, and before we get to the next mission, and so,
you got to cleanse the palate.
I thought, yeah, absolutely. I guess if you're James Bond, right, you know, right. And he's working on his Danish, I think it was
brushing up on a little Danish, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So I mean, who could blame him? We get to the actual Bond women here, and Paris Carver, Terry Hatcher, you know, she was a big deal at the time. You know, you had Lois and Clark and stuff, and so I wondered what you guys thought of her and her portrayal of the character and just her character in general and who she is with, you know, relation to James Bond.
So I have to say right off the bat, this was my surprise. I was so sad that she did not get a bigger role, because Lois and Clark was my jam, okay? I was 10 years old when Lois and Clark was on TV, and my dad and I watched it religiously. That was the first time I remember I ever saw a to be continued till a next season a year later, and I was so upset. I was like, they can't do that to me. Like, it just, that was my show. I love Dean Cain and I love Terry Hatcher. So anyway.
Wow. That's it. You definitely have an emotional attachment to this.
I do.
That's good to know. Yeah. I mean, I kind of remember, obviously I knew that Terry Hatcher was a big deal at the time. I also watched Lewis and Clark, thought it was a really good show. It was almost, it wasn't stunt casting, but it was something that I was just very aware of, like, oh, well, here's a Bond woman who is already a big deal and already well known to American audiences, at least, because of Lois and Clark. But I was very pleased to see that this character had this sort of underlying sadness and the give and take that she had with Bond. And you know, we never like to see the character who's just the sacrificial lamb in a Bond movie. But what I really liked is that her story had some resonance in this. They gave a background you could understand and believe. They gave her a situation in the present that you could understand and believe. And there is a real impact for Bond when her end is revealed. It wasn't just him walking in, finding her body, and thinking, oh, this is terrible, and I'm about to get killed, I need to get out of it. There's at least three times in that whole sequence that he keeps kind of going back to her. Mm-hmm. And you see him process what's going on. So I thought, even though she had that short time in the movie, it's a time with some impact. And it deepens a little more of what we have out of this Bond.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, John. And I think my favorite part of their interaction was when she says, did I get too close for comfort? And then he says, yes, because I didn't think he was going to give that away. Because, you know, we always see Bond as this very guarded person where it's like he's got two separate lives. You know, he has his missions and then he has, you know, women that come and go. Right. But, you know, there was that one time where he had, you know, the woman of his life and lost her. And then now, you know, we're seeing another relationship that got pretty serious, but he decided to push her away. And then seeing them meet up again. So I loved that depth as well, and that it wasn't just she was some random girl and then they killed her off.
Yeah.
What I thought was really interesting about that, you know, Moneypenny and M are kind of giving Bond a hard time in the car, you know, about having to reconnect with her, and M is being very cavalier about how, you know, you get as close as you need and pump her for information, and they're making all these kind of innuendo jokes and everything. And yet Bond is very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I thought the way that we get Brosnan playing this here is that he does not want to see this woman again. This is mm-hmm. not a mission he wants. He left her for a reason, and she has had a mark on him. And I think the way that he plays it, when, you know, he knows she's going to come and he's drinking, you know, vodka straight, you know, you can tell this is not a man who is happy with the assignment that he has been given, that he needs to rekindle something with her, because you get the feeling like Bond needs this to be dead mm-hmm. as a relationship, and he doesn't want her. And the reason is because you he doesn't want to get reconnected, but he also, I think, he doesn't want her getting hurt, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And like, there's all this emotion there. And I think it's something that I felt like was just very well done, especially in the portrayal with Brosnan. And I think Terry Hatcher does a pretty good job in the role. And I think she makes it believable. And like you were saying, John, the sadness that she has is of a woman who chose to marry somebody who she's probably quite disappointed that she's married to, and is very unhappy in that relationship. And, you know, there's all those type of things going on as well. And, you know, when she says, you know, I missed you, to Bond, as they're about to fall into bed together, you believe it, you know, you believe that there was something there. And you get the feeling almost like he broke her.
Yeah.
Spirit at that point, and she ended up choosing Elliot because he was kind of this safe, you know, thing that was going to just take care of her, and that's all that mattered. Mm-hmm. And so I thought all of that was just, it's a really nice thing that if you are going to have her die in the script, that there was so much more going on than her just being somebody he met at the you know, like if he had met the blonde.
Yeah.
That helped Carver, you know, the announcer at the event, you know, that it's not her, it's somebody that's actually important to Bond himself. And I think the thing that really bothers me, though, is doing some research and hearing that Monica Bellucci had screen tested for the role, and as Brosnan put it, and I think it's perfectly, the fool said no. I can't imagine. I like Terry Hatcher here, but when I know what Monica Bellucci did in the minuscule time that she had in Spectre, I can imagine her here in her prime of just like amazingness and beauty, and like she's still one of the most beautiful people on the planet. But just at this time period, I think she would have been even a better pick for this role, because I kind of expect Carver to probably be married to somebody exotic. Mm-hmm. That makes even more sense, you know. Give the I don't know, Donald Trump likes his exotic women, right? So I can see Carver wanting exotic women as well. But I just, oh, that broke my heart when they said that they did not cast her. I was like, oh God, are you serious?
Yeah.
But that is not the only Bond woman that we get in this movie, and I think they both kind of break convention for the most part, and actually turn out to be some of the best written female characters that we get in Bond movies up to this point. You know, we get Wei-Lin, played by the wonderful Michelle Yeoh. This is the first time I think I really saw her, except for Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was the other one around this time. And I love this character, you know, and I think Michelle Yeoh is so much fun as this no-nonsense, doesn't put up with Bond's crap, you know. She has no time for him. And the competition between them at the beginning of the film, when they're, you know, when he sees her walking down the wall, mm-hmm. and he's just like, you son of a, you know, like, you lucky person.
Like,
you know,
of course, like, you get walk away.
Yes, like the whole thing, like, I felt was, she's perfectly cast, and I love the way that they play the character. It's really, really well written.
And they get to do some of the best action sequences together. I wrote down in my notes that the underwater scenes in the boat, when the two of them are on the Devonshire, was great because, I mean, it's very intense when you're seeing, oh no, the boat's tipping over. They might sink to the bottom of the ocean. Oh no, all of the missiles have blocked the door. How are they going to get out? You know, was great. And then they get to do that motorcycle chase together, which was even better with them being handcuffed together. And the whole joke about her going, don't get any ideas, which she says twice. it was great. And they give her such credit as a female character in a Bond movie, you know, of, like you said, you know, not having time for his games. She's got an agenda of her own and she's not looking for romance. She's got stuff to get done.
She's awesome. There is nothing about her character that I don't like. There's nothing about her performance that I don't like. And I remember liking Wei Lin when I first saw this movie, but rewatching, and I've watched it in the years since, clearly, but rewatching it for this show, and maybe it's because I sort of, you know, fell in love again with Michelle Yeoh on Discovery, on Star Trek, mm-hmm, Discovery, for those of you listening to Trek FM who don't know what Discovery is, and just thought, oh, she's cool, she's powerful, she's clearly got range as an actor. Being able to go back and watch this again and just really pay attention to her performance, she makes the most out of every scene. And if they had done another Bond movie together, I would have been very happy with that too.
She's so great too at the being coy about everything. She plays her cards close to her chest and she's always just, you know, messing with him, but not revealing anything. I had to throw that in there.
In a lot of ways, I feel like they, by the time she gets on screen, they write her almost as a co-lead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And totally. So, you know, she's not playing second fiddle to Bond. And then, you know, when she, they go back and forth throughout the film of needing to help each other or save each other, which is nice too. So when any of those happen, it's more about, well, we've seen Bond get captured before, you know, so we know that can happen. And he does in this film, and they go back and forth of helping her. And I just really, I appreciate that about her character. And I think, you know, as you said, John, there's just nothing about her you don't like in this movie. I feel exactly the same way. And what I kind of like is that by the time they get to the end and they've destroyed the stealth boat and they're, you know, canoodling on a part of it, you know, it feels like the same thing that you that Bond get, like the like, okay, this is the time for frivolity. It wasn't earlier, mm-hmm, but yeah, you know, now is the time when we can enjoy the spoils of having won the day, you know. So even them you know, gonna have sex at the end, it kind of makes even more sense than a lot of the other Bond movies because, one, they've been through something together,
yeah,
like that. But two, they're both spies, you know, and so we get the feeling like she's the James Bond of China, mm-hmm, the Jane Bond of China. So, you know, I love the way that they write her character because she's never second fiddle to Bond, I don't feel like, in the film, and she feels like his equal in every way, and that's great writing.
Yep.
Well, talk about, you know, cars and motorcycles and helicopters. Oh my! You know, this movie is, I think, jam packed with some memorable Bond action sequence. And rewatching it, I was surprised just how many great action sequences I think that this movie had, and it added some. You know, when I think of back now, it actually adds some scenes that I'm like, yeah, these stack up with, you know, the rest of the Bond franchise. When you've got the opening action sequence, you've got a halo jump, remote control cars that don't feel dumb, and two people handcuffed on a motorcycle being chased by a helicopter. I mean, that, I don't know what more you could want in a Bond movie.
Right, and the helicopter even flying so low to the ground that the blades are chopping things as it's going by.
Yeah. I mean, the Halo jump is impressive on its own. Like I said, the opening scene is great. The remote control car, it's a believable car. You know, it's a BMW. We've seen BMWs. Nobody's that good at a remote control with anything, but, right. You know, that scene is just so good.
Bond played a lot of 007.
He must GoldenEye. Have. Yeah, clearly.
That's how he got so good.
Yeah, right. But a part of what makes that scene so good is the confine of the parking deck. And you see the walls coming down and all that stuff. It's just great. The pacing of that scene, I love even opening that with the little bit of comedy of the guys touching the handles and getting shocked, mm-hmm. and then going back to do it again and continuing to get shocked. It's like, duh, you idiot. He's terrific in that scene, but that motorcycle chase, it, to me, is perfection because it manages to tonally hit all the right notes. So it's serious, but it doesn't feel deadly serious. It doesn't feel brooding. It's just like, oh, okay, they're in danger. This is happening. But with that said, it's light where it needs to be light, but it's not silly. There's no slide whistle. There's no triple take pigeon. There's none of that stuff. And then going back to their chemistry, their relationship, that scene is not just a great action scene. It is acted well by Pierce Brosnan and Michelle Yeoh. There's this sort of flirtation without it feeling like we're breaking from the scene. It doesn't feel out of nowhere. The stunts are great without it feeling like it's totally science fiction. The first time I watched that scene, I just remember like all of us, where you're just taken in by the action. What's going to happen next? They're driving on a roof. They're going to jump over a helicopter. You know, watching it again and just watching their performances, I think it's hands down one of the best Bond action sequences because they never overstep their bounds, but they still manage to wow us in every shot.
It's important in a Bond action sequence to feel plausible and probable at the same time, and fantastic. And this one, I think you're absolutely right, Don. It does, because I feel like they can do everything that they do in the sequence, but it also feels Bond fantastical, you know. And they found the magic in, I think, all of the action sequences that they created. You know, that remote control car is genius.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's just genius. And the pure joy on Brosnan's face when he's like, you know, dropping the little, you know, poppers on the ground so they get the tires, you know, and they, you know, or he's going to, you know, blow up a car with a missile or any of those things. It's just really well acted. And even just the scenes of him turning and being thrown in the car, like, you're never taken out of the scene. That for the most part, I think the effects work in this movie is really well done, and they kept at a minimum where they were, you know, doing an effect, you know, like them falling, you know, with the banner and stuff, so that so much of it again does what Bond does best, which is to feel real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you're never really taking out of these major action sequences like the remote control car or them being on the motorcycle, where you're just like, that doesn't look right. I never had that problem. And so,
yeah,
you know, I have so much fun watching these, and wow. Yeah. I think when I think of this film now, I'm like, yeah, this has some of the, I mean, it holds up to having, like, they knew they weren't going to outdo the tank. And,
right.
You know, you're just not going to outdo the tank. But yeah, you do something that is completely different and just as inventive as that, and you got it, and they nailed it. So, Chrissy, you mentioned earlier about how David Arnold's score really sold you in some places. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you guys about that, because obviously the score for the last movie was a travesty, a train wreck. I mean, adjective that I could express at that moment. It's god awful. In fact, I don't think God had anything to do with that. I'm pretty sure he didn't, or it would have been better. But David Arnold comes in, and this freaking score sounds like classic Bond. And what is great, I don't know if you guys knew this, but John Barry actually recommended him.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So that's where it comes from. Yeah, it totally sold me. I mean, of course, you can tell all the places where they brought in the classic Bond themes back. But I think the best parts where it really shined for me was in the action scenes. I felt like Arnold did such a great job with using music to build the tension and make you feel like those people were doing their own stunts and that, you know, the situation was really happening. Every single time I felt myself like clenching my blanket going, oh my God, even though I knew what was going to happen already, I was still going, are they going to make it? And so I think there's no higher compliment I could pay him than that. So I think it was perfect. The only thing I didn't like was, even though I like Sheryl Crow, usually I don't like her singing a Bond opening song, because I was telling my husband, it kind of sounds to me like she struggles with the high notes. That's what bothered me.
You are so just speaking right to me. All right. The David Arnold score is great. And no pun intended, it hits all the right notes. The modern stuff sounds of its era without sounding dated,
yep.
Which is a problem with some Bond soundtracks. The references to classic Bond in there are spot on perfect. The Sheryl Crow song, if I never hear it again for as long as I live, that will be too soon. I remembered hating that song, and then I'm like, okay, well, for this rewatch, I just need to seriously rewatch the whole movie, even though I know I'll cringe during that song. It was even worse than I remembered it. You're right. She struggles through that song. She's screechy. It does not fit her voice or her style at all. Let's move on and talk about something much more important. The Katie Lang song, Surrender, that is in my top five of all Bond songs of all time. David Arnold, stroke of genius, said, okay, if you're going to hand me this Sheryl Crow song, I'm going to come up with my own song with Katie Lang. We're going to throw it in there. And then he cleverly wrote the incidental music in the movie to reference that song. Because
nice.
He knew it was the better piece. I love, love, love that song. And there was something about the soundtrack that may not have been saved if they didn't have it.
The problem is that I felt like they didn't write a song for Sheryl Crow.
Right.
And mm-hmm. that's the issue. And I feel like, you know, if you had another singer do that song, it would have been a good song. Because I don't feel like the song itself is bad. I feel like the singing of the song is bad.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work. I agree. It's not like I dislike Sheryl Crow. I like Sheryl Crow for the most part. I just don't feel like it fits here. And so, I agree with you, John. The Katie Lang song is better. Mm. But David Arnold's soundtrack is a masterpiece. You know, and the fact that they keep bringing him back, throughout the rest of Brosnan's era, I'm pretty sure that he's back for the rest of them, if I remember correctly, which, thank God, he really, I think he understands exactly what a Bond soundtrack is supposed to sound like. And like you said, John, one of the joys of the music here is the fact that when he does do something that's a little bit more modern, it still fits with the classic Bond feel. So you're not pulled out, which is wonderful. And so I've listened to this one a few times over the last few weeks, just because I like listening to the soundtrack, especially when I enjoy it as we're getting closer to doing the movie. And I was really enjoying re-listening to this one and the fact that he had done, you know, such a good job. And so I really appreciate that. And, you know, it makes me excited for the fact that I know he's back for The World Is Not Enough. And so, you know, gosh. And can we just say, on the soundtrack, the Moby rendition of the James Bond theme,
it's great.
The reimagining that he does is incredible.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Oh.
Yeah.
When they have the little interlude and they put in the Goldfinger, you expect me to talk? No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. It's so perfect. I mean, it just, oh, it's so great. So, yeah, if you don't have this one as a soundtrack, go find it somewhere. You know, it really is one that you will enjoy listening to, I think, over and over again. It will make your workday much more epic. So,
yeah.
For you guys, you know, we've had a lot of good things to say about Tomorrow Never Dies. So I'm very interested to get to our ratings and to see where you guys, you know, kind of put your stamp on it. And so, Christy, for you, Tomorrow Never Dies, what do you got?
So I do have to throw in there two people we didn't get to mention, three actually, but two big names that everybody will know. Gerard Butler made a cameo in this movie. He was a crewman on the Devonshire going down. I was like,
oh my gosh, I can't. Oh, that's great.
It's my man. I love him. Anyway, so also Vincent Schiavelli.
Yes.
Yeah, as Dr. Kaufman, y'all.
yes.
So great.
I remembered him most from Ghost, actually, because he was so freaking terrifying. but yeah, I love him. And so I was glad that he was in this movie as that assassin character. He's perfect as a villain. I love him. And then the other one, I was glad to see Joe Don Baker was back as Jack Wade.
Yep. 100%.
And that he's still just playing the kind of like Texan sounding guy who's like, you know, we were never here, right?
Right.
It was the best. He seems like a guy that you want to hang out with.
Yeah. Hold on. Did you hear anybody say Devonshire? I didn't hear anybody say Devonshire.
Yeah.
Love him. Yeah. He's great. And Vincent Schiavelli, he hit the right note of being menacing and weird, but he also had that just little bit of comedic. He wasn't delivering comedy. You just could tell that he was aware of the comedy of what was going on too. It was just enough. Like, he wasn't going for the joke, but his discomfort, all of that was just so good. I love him, and it's such a small part, but it's so memorable. Because it's creepy and weird. Yeah.
And I feel like it's memorable, too, because then he has to go, stop yelling in my ear. What?
Yeah, right. He plays it exactly right.
Oh, so funny.
So what did you rate it?
That's true. I probably need to give it an actual number. Sorry, I'm talking about all the people I loved. I give it an 8 out of 10 because it had such amazing action to it. I loved the soundtrack. It had all of these big name actors that I thought worked really well in a movie. Usually I feel like when a movie has that many people I've known so well from other things, it can tend to not have as good of a plot, but it didn't feel that way at all. And I was really glad to see a Bond woman getting to be, you know, on the same level as Bond with Michelle Yeoh. I just was really impressed again on my rewatch of this movie. I don't remember liking it as much the first time I saw it. So I give it an 8 out of 10.
Sweet. One thing that we didn't talk a lot about in this episode is Pierce Brosnan. And because we gave him a lot of attention last time with GoldenEye, rightfully so. But thinking back on our discussion on GoldenEye, there was something in that movie that didn't click as well with me as I thought it would. Because I remember liking that movie a lot, and then just something about rewatching it, it wasn't firing on all cylinders for me all the time, even though there's so much in that movie that I love. Couldn't quite put my finger on it. Maybe I felt like in GoldenEye, they kept having to telegraph to us, this is James Bond. just over and over and over again, whether it was in the movie itself or in the lead up to the movie, just sort of the press anticipation around Pierce Brosnan, the changeover from Timothy Dalton to him. But they kept having to remind you this is James Bond. In this movie, I just felt like he's James Bond. He just is, and he just is solid in that role, and the movie just has to unfold around him. I also feel like it's just a very straightforward movie about who's doing what the relationships are, what the complications are, and where we need to end up. Sadly, I'm anticipating what's coming with the Pierce Brosnan Bond movies. And I don't want my ranking to be a comparative ranking, because I it doesn't suit me. I don't think it suits anybody listening to this show to say, well, here's where it ranks compared to the other Brosnan, and here's where it ranks compared to the other Bond movies in general. I think for me, I always like to approach this as how well does this movie succeed at what it's trying to do, just as a singular unit. How well does this movie perform based on what they were trying to do? Amazing stunts, great soundtrack, a lead actor who I feel like just completely nails it in every moment, and a counterpart with Michelle Yeoh who completely nails it in every moment. There's so much that I like about this, and what I don't like is pretty minor. I think if there's a weak link here, we all agree that it might just have something to do with the bad guy. Even though there's a lot about the bad guy that we really like, at least the premise of the bad guy that we all really like. So I'm actually going to give this 9.5 flame-throwing dragons, as we saw in Wei Lin's lab.
I mean, who doesn't have one?
Well, I've got two behind me. I'm afraid to reach back too far.
Yeah.
Torch this show.
I tell you what, it lights the cigar like nothing else, right?
No, right.
I really enjoyed getting to listen to your guys' ratings, because I feel like you both pulled out so many great parts of this movie. So I don't have a lot to say other than I think you're both 100% correct in your assessment. John, I appreciate you pulling out specifically Brosnan. That was something that I was thinking as I was watching the movie, just how comfortable he is in this role, how effortless it was for him. And I felt like he was able to stretch his wings a little bit. And part of that was the material they gave him with like the Paris Carver character and that kind of stuff. So that was really nice. And the joy of kind of watching him play off an equal with Wei Lin, which was also, I think, really enjoyable. We don't get to see a lot in a Bond movie where he is truly with an equal. And so all of that, you know, this movie, like you said, it's almost like the Mary Poppins of James Bond movies. You know, it's practically perfect in every way, except for two words, stealth boat. You know, so because of that, I am going to give this... I'm going to give this 9 out of 10 stealth boats.
Wow. So, I'm going to send you a picture of the real stealth boat, the Sea Shadow from 1982, the IX-529.
Oh, I got to see that. Okay.
Created
by
Lockheed.
I can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
I cannot wait to see it. So maybe we'll share that on Twitter, too, with the Trek FM followers, just so they can see that. But I absolutely love that we have this experience, you know, I mean, that this Bond movie was so much fun to watch. And I think it felt like to me that we all kind of came into this one going, oh, you know, Tomorrow Never Dies, you know, okay. And it felt like to me that this is a movie that kind of surprised us all where we ended up in our ratings, which I think it's an underrated Bond movie. When people are listing great Bond movies, they just don't think about this one. And I don't know, and maybe it's because GoldenEye is universally recognized for so many people as like Brosnan's possible best, but I think you can make an argument that maybe this is his best. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I will have to have that discussion at the end of Die Another Day. Although I do know that if you're going to create an equal for Bond, you do it this way, not the jinx.
Wait, anyway. Or Madonna.
let's not talk about that song right now. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us, everyone. I really appreciate it. Want to say a special thanks to our associate producers here through Patreon, Ken Tripp, Davis Grayson, and Daniel Noah, who has joined us as well. Thank you guys so much for supporting the network and specifically the 602 Club, pulling that out as the show you wanted to support. It's a massive undertaking to do this thing we call Trek FM. It's very expensive, and we can't do it alone. So if you want to help the network, you can go over to patreon.com/trekfm and become a partner with us. Make sure everything that we're doing here each and every week comes to you. We have amazing shows almost every single day of the week coming out to you. And, you know, they're ad-free for you guys. So if you want to keep it that way, we've got some great contribution levels where you have even more to give back to you. But honestly, every little bit helps. So go over to patreon.com/trekfm and see how you can be part of the team. Now, Christy, I know you have so much going on. We happen to be talking off the show about the idea of geek fashion. Well, you're a geek fashion wizard. So let everybody know what else you are doing these days and where they should be following you, which they should be following you.
Well, thank you so much for that lovely introduction. Yes, so you can follow me on Galactic Fashion Pod on Instagram and Galactic Fashion on Twitter. On the podcast with my friend Teresa Delgado. We talk once a month about what's going on in geek fashion. And we've got big news this week because it's San Diego Comic-Con as we're recording this. So stay tuned for that. And you can find me personally at Bespin Bell, B-E-L-L-E, on Twitter and Instagram as well.
And Mr. John Champion, if people would like to find you, where can they do that? And where should they be following you?
Well, I would love it if people would look up Mission Log Pod. So that's the Mission Log Podcast site, either Twitter or Facebook, Mission Log Pod. Or you can go to podcast.roddenberry.com to check out Mission Log and all the other shows that we're slowly adding to the Roddenberry banner. And if you want to find me personally, at DVD Geeks on Twitter, that's where I'll talk Mon, not so much on the Mission Log site. Sure, Instagram, Slow Mo Gentleman. Haven't been slow recently, but it is convention season right now, so maybe I'll be able to throw in some more slowness in there soon.
Well, and just a teaser, there may be some very special swim trunks coming to Slow Mo Gentlemen as well. So you are going to be wanting to follow that because we have something in store for you.
Yes.
So
keep it PG.
Yes,
absolutely.
Now. Keep it PG. No, it's PG. Well, I don't know about PG.
It's PG. It's just slow.
Yeah. Yeah. If PG stands for perfect guy.
Zing. Oh, you're hired. You are hired, man.
Well, you can find me on Twitter as well. I'm not quite as slow as John, but I'm just not as cool as him. I'm MattRushing02. I'm also on Instagram under the same name. I'm here on the network talking The Orb with Chris Jones, all about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. We hope to be back with new episodes soon, so stay tuned. You can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network. I'm talking about Star Wars with John Mills over on Aggressive Negotiation. It is such a fun show to do with him as we just dive into the Star Wars universe each and every week and talk about a fun topic there. So you can also find me doing Owl Post with Dre Kaufman, talking about each and every chapter of the Harry Potter series. One chapter at a time. We are actually right in the middle of the Goblet of Fire right now, which it's been a joy to be doing that. And then last but not least, I'm doing Cinema Stories with my good friend Courtney as we talk all about films through the lens of faith. But I want to say thank you so much for joining us, and y'all come back now, you hear?